Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. In his autobiography, the great American writer Mark Twain describes being at the end of the Earth Club and witnessing its chairman, a retired army officer, pronounce that we are of the Anglo-Saxon race, and when the Anglo-Saxon wants a thing, he just takes it. A century later, this attitude is enshrined in many American strategic documents and speeches of its politicians. But can it finally find its end in Ukraine, hopefully without the end of the earth? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Australia by Binoy Kampmark, senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne. Professor, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Now, you're very far away from the focal point of this new confrontation between Russia and the West, the confrontation in which references to nuclear strikes are becoming more and more frequent. I wonder if this distance gives you any relief, because if things indeed go nuclear, Australia will be among the last to feel the impact.
It's a very nice question. Well, it's a grim question, but it's a nice question in a way. Because I don't know if you are familiar with the particular novel by Neville Shute called On the Beach. On the Beach was actually filmed, made into a film in the 1950s. And in it, Eva Gardner actually visited Melbourne, where I am based at the moment. Now, it's never been quite confirmed whether she said this, the famous American actress, but she had these wonderful lines. She sort of said, if this is a place to film the end of the world, this is exactly where we need to be. And the irony of the story is that, of course, the novel features Australia as the last place where radioactive fallout comes in the aftermath of a nuclear holocaust. So Australia is the last place, supposedly, where these things will happen. And in fact, it's an interesting point to note that there are individuals from the United States, multi-billionaires and a few other countries who are buying up places because they want to retreat in the event that there might be a nuclear holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting observation. And the reason I ask you this question is because there's a lot of gallows humor here in Moscow. And just the other day, one of my military friends tried to reassure me that in the case of a nuclear apocalypse, Moscow is a good place to be because of the instantaneous death. You don't have to suffer. But I think we can take it as a defense against a very grim possibility that only a couple of years ago seemed fully dystopian. How do you think we found ourselves in this place after spending so much time and effort and money on nuclear disarmament only 30 years ago?
Well, I think the response to that question is based on a few things. One is, I actually don't think the nuclear issue ever really went away. I think the threat of nuclear weapons has always been there, and the threat of using them has always been simmering. Be it, for example, Pakistan and India at stages, that, let's face it, throughout the acquisition, for example, of Pakistan's nuclear capability, you know, when India acquired a potential, Pakistan obviously needed to acquire one. One needs a Hindu bomb, one needs a Muslim bomb, and these sorts of things. But in the context of it, it's never really gone away. We shouldn't forget, for example, that even before the attack on Iraq, so for example, and this, by the way, is the first one. This is the in 1991, when, of course, the coalition there led by the United States, headed by President George Bush's father, George W. Bush's father. His defense secretary then, who of course ends up being vice president with Bush Jr., as it were, when he comes to power later, Dick Cheney actually advocated the potential use of nuclear weapons against the Iraqi forces. It's never really gone away. So I think now it's been articulated to a high extent because of the circumstances where, call it desperation, call it rhetoric, whatever it might be. The fact is that if one is in a situation where one needs to potentially, wave the saber, jangle a few notes and whatnot, this is what's happening.
I understand that these references to nuclear strikes, they can be very distressing for some people, but there was a belief during the Cold War that fear is actually very instrumental in politics because it keeps the politicians thinking grounded, you know. This is something that limits their ambition. And you make the point in your writing that the West's desire for quote-unquote victory over Russia has become a fixation, and a fixation without a full understanding of what that victory may actually mean in practical terms. As far as you can deduct from the speeches of politicians or from strategic documents, if the West could have its ideal way, what would it mean with regards to Russia?
To get to that question, let me just put it like this. Your listeners may be familiar with an old Marxist historian. He's no longer with us. He died actually not that long ago. His name is Eric Hobsbawm. And he was a very fine student and pupil of that complex negotiation between East and West and also the Cold War. Of course, he was very much in the tradition of that donnish, you know, English appraisal about, you know, the Cold War, but also the 20th century and, in fact, the 19th century. He's very famous for putting together this list of works, trying to understand these very tumultuous last 150 years or so. And, you know, for Eric Hobsbawm, he made this very striking remark that I'll never forget, that the end of the Soviet Union was essentially the end of a stable system, a control system from Trieste in the West, of course, and then to Vladivostok. So, and that was, of course, writing at that point when the Soviet Union had ceased to exist. The object of this kind of thing, and I'm sad to say that it's reached the point where the fixation and the obsession with dealing with Russia is such that they, and this is this kind of defeat obsession, or they want to defeat Russia, and it's, you know, as much as one can understand where people have stakes in this, it's a very dangerous prospect to try to talk about all-out defeat and things like that, because that may raise the stakes in other areas, but it also raises the prospect about what happens in Russia. And I think that that is also very problematic on several levels. The fact of the matter is that, you know, people are not coming to this in good faith. And I know it's very hard to come to good faith in terms of war and battle and whatnot, but there's so many people from various countries investing in attacking Russia now that it becomes difficult to necessarily, you know, the idea is not to seek, you know, a consensus and an understanding about peace between Ukraine and Russia, but the idea is essentially we've got Russia on the run and this is what we're going to do. And this is where things become very dangerous.
But Professor, you said a moment ago that it's hard to sort of approach war in a good faith. But I mean, military science is a science. And I mean, at least in Russia and I hope in the West, it's approached from a strategic and tactical point of view. You have to consider your goals. You have to consider your means. You have to consider possible consequences. I mean, and there is a long list of literature by American writers on how you actually operate war, how you try to achieve the results. Mm. And I sometimes get a sense that the American decision makers or Western decision makers don't even bother about, you know, second order consequences, let alone something that may come, I don't know, 5 or 10 years down the line. Do you share that impression?
Well, there are a few things you mentioned. One of them is the science. Well, I'm afraid to say is, yes, it's true that it's been elevated, this notion of, you know, military doctrine to science. But sadly, it sort of, to me, it more resembles a kind of a fallible art form, you know, when it comes to military doctrine. And what I mean by that is that you just need to look at the writings of the Prussian general staff. So the old German staff before Germany was unified, this is the first unification. And there was this famous marshal, this famous general called Helmut von Moltke, who actually said that you can, of course, always plan, you know, as scientifically as you want. I say scientifically, he didn't quite use those words, but he said you can plan for every scenario you want on the battlefield. You can plan for anything. You can plan for, you know, as rigorously as you want, you know, 10 scenarios, but on battle and in circumstances, the 11th happens. The same thing in terms of strategy here, broadly speaking. The issue is to be wise enough to anticipate that there has to be leg room. That's the point. And the issue here is, yes, I think it's, if you look at every historical strategy in history, these are usually strategies of old dictates. So the documents, when you talk about referring to documents, they're already dated. They already have that musty smell of the library, of the archive. They don't apply for the circumstances that are immediate.
Well, certainly the circumstances are new, but at the very least, one has to consider and analyze an opponent. And Russia at this point of time is at its strongest point militarily, economically, I would claim socially, than it has ever been. If the goal is to, let's say, weaken Russia, or as we've been hearing lately, change the regime in Russia, why would the West wait for so long and allow Russia to accumulate that strength? And the second question to that, does the West actually have the resources, its own capabilities, military capabilities, strategic capabilities, political capabilities, to take on a country the size of Russia?
Well, first and foremost, I don't think, and this is the general consensus, very sadly, here, is that when I say here, I mean broadly in the Western context, the strategic community, is that there is a perception that Russia is actually not that strong, and that Russia is in fact being weakened. I mean,
the generals surely know all the, and Putin is very good at signaling. He showed them what Russia possesses in terms of hypersonic weapons and what have you.
Sure.
I mean, people who are in the know, it's the general public that may be led astray, but people who make decisions, they actually know about that.
Ah, yes. Well, alas, my understanding of history generally, there was this, in the context of the First World War, for example, it was said rather well by those who started to write about it afterwards that, for example, the British Army were led by, they were led by donkeys. There were lions being led by donkeys. So, in terms of strategic sense, I think for your audience to understand this, I think it's important to realize that the general approach, and this is the media cycle here, whether they think privately or not is another thing, but what they're doing here in terms of signaling, you mentioned what Vladimir Putin is doing signaling there. The signaling is the opposite. It's the mirror opposite. It's Russia is weakened. Russia does not have enough in terms of its weaponry. It does not have targeted weaponry. It's running out of it. It's using now indiscriminately weapons that it has from Soviet era. So that's the context that's happening here. So beyond that context, and I think this is the thing, and I think that gets back to the question that you mentioned, which is very important. What is the ultimate goal? The ultimate goal is a weakened Russia. And that raises all sorts of deeper problems, of course.
Well, but of course, I'm sure you would agree with me. One cannot weaken Russia by pretending that it's weak. I mean, if you actually want to win over a powerful adversary, you need to be fully aware of the strength and the weaknesses.
Look, you're mentioning something about a country that is, of course, very powerful. I mean, for goodness sake, the largest on the planet, straddling the Eurasian landmass, of course, from Europe to the borders with Japan. I mean, there's no question about it. It's not that it can't be taken. It has to be taken seriously in that. But I think this is one of the reasons why it troubles me a lot, is that a lot of the tactical and the strategic approach to this is not realizing the fact that, one, Russia is not going away. Two, Russia has genuine considerations in the context of the Ukraine conflict. Three, yes, whatever one describes it in the context of aggression, the reality also remains that there were serious issues that were linked to the conflict originally. These have been ignored. NATO wants expansion, and NATO wants to be globalized in its role, which is extraordinary and very dangerous. This has global implications.
Professor Kamberg, this is a fascinating point that we have to explore in more detail. So let's take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Binoy Kampmark, Senior Lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne. Professor Kampmark, before the break, we touched upon the prevailing attitudes among Western elites. And it is my perception that when it comes to Russia, they roughly fall within the two camps. Both want Russia's capitulation, but one camp is mindful of and concerned about limiting the costs of achieving that goal to themselves, while the other camp, represented by, for example, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, believe that this is something that has to be accomplished at any cost. So the distinction between the doves and the hawks is not really about what they are aiming at, but rather about the cost of their policy. Am I right here, or do you perhaps see a third camp of somewhat saner decision makers?
Many years ago, in the context of your question, so just this is to give the background that even throughout the 90s, when there was this kind of sort of a euphoria, but sort of this sense that things had changed, that the Cold War had, as it were, ebbed, and there was not a sense of worrying about things, and the world order had altered. There were very sharp remarks and observations made by various individuals throughout. You know, some of them, for example, like Professor Mearsheimer, who's made this point very clearly that Russia has its strategic interests that need to be respected. We even had, of course, the person, former State Department official George Kennan, who's no longer with us, but he famously said, he's the author, as some of your viewers might be familiar, he was famously the author of the telegram in the 1940s that led to the doctrine of containment of the Soviet Union. And he said in the aftermath of the Cold War and with the mutterings of the advance of NATO that this was folly. This was, very dangerous. And this, added to the fact that the, Bush administration, this is Bush Senior, the administration, of course, ultimately that presided over the reunification of Germany and a range of other things and negotiations with Gorbachev. The promises that were made then, these were not minor things. Many individuals were part of promises and assurances given to the Russian delegation, then Soviet delegation, constantly. If you accept these propositions, and it was extraordinary, in many ways, Gorbachev didn't have to do what he did. With the late, of course.
Yeah, but he did it out of the goodwill. And I think one of the factors that is not fully appreciated in the West is that Russia actually supported the reunification of Germany. I mean, Russia allowed it to happen, and it felt deceived afterwards. And now it feels that if it has to protect some of the lands that were formerly the Soviet lands or the Ukrainian lands, it can do that. I mean, if you remember, after the reunification with Crimea, Putin specifically addressed the German nation, saying that we supported you back then. We count on the same historic justice from your side, but obviously it's not coming.
You make that point. This is exactly what I was getting at. The fact is that there were various gestures made and the extraordinary, in that sense, goodwill from Gorbachev. I mean, when it came to the issue of the fall of the Berlin Wall and not sending in tanks and so on, I mean, these kind of things. The issue of reunification was extraordinary. There was a lot of opposition, even in some European quarters. But the fact of the matter is, it came from the Kremlin at that particular point that this could happen. And so reassurances or undertakings were given. And then what happened subsequently was that actually, President Bush Sr. actually just made the remarks specifically, oh God, there was a throwaway line. So the archives actually have that. They actually have these remarks made by individuals who gave those undertakings and then in the scheme. And that's the danger of hubris, that old a Greek term, by being so confident in having a weakened Russia, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that, okay, we gave undertakings, but the circumstances have changed now. So, you're absolutely right to acknowledge the historical role here and the fact that it's back to what you were saying with these two camps. We accept elements of the Russian issue, but also there are those who want total victory. But they have been those, actually suggesting that this is absolute madness and very dangerous to keep persisting along this line. And it's worth noting that many of those who do say that have been subjected to black labeling, libeling, you name it. It's very hard to get a debate about this in any coherent context in the strategic communities, militarily and politically in Western circles.
You mentioned NATO before, and I think we need to transition to that subject. I think there is a belief here in Moscow that NATO doesn't actually want Ukraine in because as things stand right now, they're already getting everything they want from Ukraine without having any obligations, without having the need to come to its defenses. They can just use it without any consequences. And I wonder if that makes this conflict even more dangerous because of all the asymmetries between what is said and what is being done. Because Russia, after all, it subscribes to a realist point of view and it doesn't look at the speeches of Western leadership. It looks at what is being done on the ground. And if Ukraine is being militarized, if Western infrastructure moves there without any formal association with NATO, it's still a threat for Russia. So don't you think that this way of sort of proxy taking over Ukraine is even more dangerous than, Ukraine being part of NATO?
The treatment of, in line of what you are saying, the treatment of Ukraine is not... it reminds me of the way that other proxies, other allies in the context, for example, of the United States and Pakistan, the way that Pakistan has been treated in the U.S. constellation of power at stages. There was a Pakistani general, and that explains also why the relationship is so tense between those two powers. The Pakistani general in question said that we are essentially America's condom and they dispose of us when they want after they've used it. So the use of proxies of the use, this notion that Ukraine will be slotted in, I mean, of course, first of all, any sort of slotting in, it's not going to be a slotting in, it's going to take years. Not even during this conflict, we've seen individuals from NATO and the general European and US strategic community say, well, come on, thank you very much, we'll welcome you in. You're right to say that this is becoming a kind of this proxy war where it's a testing ground. It's a means where it's being used to try to get at Russia. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go full in for Ukrainian, for the use of Ukraine as part of NATO either. I actually don't necessarily see that at all. And I think, it reminds me again of the terrible tragedies that happen when allies or individuals that are backed are then at a certain moment abandoned. And it's not, look away from the fact that when it comes to certain, as you say, real power, realities, realism, and so on, it may well be that Ukraine finds itself in the middle again in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said also a moment ago that this warring spirit is fueled in part by NATO's strive to become global. And on the psychological level, I think we can all understand this omnipotent fantasy. But I wonder if that is even possible. I mean, when we look at America's own capabilities right now, its ability to shower money onto other countries, is it really realistic, given that many of America's own allies, look, for example, at Saudi Arabia, are going their own way? Does NATO have the power, the resources to become global at this point of time, regardless of Russia?
Not at all. No, it doesn't, and it won't. It's a bit like, and I can't say I missed the man, but I have to say I did always find him very comical. But of course, the recently departed Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, who had this idea of global Britain. Well, no, Britain is not global anymore. I mean, it was at one point, but certainly not. This is the kind of ambition for NATO, sort of a having hubs here and there and having some kind of ambition beyond its limited borders. But Because ultimately, let's face it, what was it designed to do? It's ultimately the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But what has happened is that they've been trying to use the Ukraine-Russia conflict to expand its relevance. And you've got even, you know, bizarrely, individuals such as the current Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who, of course, wants to be added to the list, somehow feels important, you know, wanting to add his bit to the Ukraine-Russia conflict. And so what do? You start jumping up on these particular things and not quite understanding the implications. It's the same thing with the AUKUS agreement, the security arrangement that Australia, the United States and the UK signed or declared in September. Okay, we know who's running it. We know that the US essentially is running it. The others are essentially just, you know, the butlers trying to make sure that the drinks are served.
Well, let me actually let us finish on this point, because we began with Australia, we can end with Australia as well. This country is in a very interesting position because it is far away from all the war theaters. It is safe. It would be the safest place to be in the event of a nuclear apocalypse. And yet, on the other hand, it seems to be very eager to do the US's bidding, not only with AUKUS, but also with other formats, even though it comes at a cost of very profitable, very lucrative cooperation with China and perhaps some others as well. What's the rationale there, the practical rationale, not for the decision makers, but for the people of the continent?
Not much reflection has been given about this issue. Australia has had a strange habit over the years of doing the fighting of other countries. It's one of these strange things. You know, the British have this Nepalese elite unit, the Gurkhas. And I like to always, I've said that before, I've written about it and said that Australia tend to be the Gurkhas of the United States. So they're sent, you know, and the Australian government and, you know, claims or tries to get some kind of added advantage from the United States by providing forces. But it's never really clear. Also, it should be added the fact that with this new agreement, we don't know, when I say we, I mean, you know, in Australia, we don't know in terms of what are the use of the nuclear submarines, what is the deployment issue, and so on. It's come at a huge cost to the Chinese-Australian relationship, and a more independent thinking approach would change this. It's also worth noting just on that point that Australia, encouraged by US analysis, essentially, tends to sort of see the Ukraine-Russia conflict by looking at the way China behaves. So it's quite intriguing. So to me, it's quite bizarre at some points, but they try to see the way Russia behaves in Ukraine to the way China might behave towards Taiwan. And again, that's dangerous because that's a potential conflict waiting to happen, where a country that has no interest in dealing with that will probably get involved because of fairly daft politicians.
Well, maybe that will lead to migration of those multi-billionaires somewhere closer to Siberia. We would not mind that. So on this note, Professor Kampmark, we have to leave it there, but I greatly appreciate your expertise today. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure being with you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.